One of the there's many interesting features of the crisis, and when we had the workshop in to begin this volume a year ago, I guess now, there was just an incredible range of assessments of where we were going, the structure of the crisis, and trying to understand it. I think that partly has to do with what is covered in the volume, particularly in Anwar Sheikh's essay, but also, as David will speak in a bit, just the volume and magnitude of this crisis, with some $50 trillion in assets wiped out, $21 trillion in bailout money, and on the volumes go. It's just incredible, the volume of it. Another feature I think that has to be accounted for is the way that the forms of resistance have been popping up in unexpected places throughout this, often at the margins, but often sometimes in the center. Some of the strikes that occurred over the summer in France, the volume and inventiveness of many of the actions in Greece. The events, of course, over the last few weeks in Tunisia are also a reflection of particular features of the global crisis. And I think we're still in a phase, whatever we might make about the pessimism of some of the events that have occurred, that there are going to be a huge range of important forms of resistance popping up in unexpected places. And it's hard to see, given what Leo began with on the nature of the crisis and some of the issues in terms of long-term stagnation. I think this is going to be with us for a long time, which poses, I think, in a major way, questions of how we are going to politically respond, not only in initial insurgencies, but over the longer term of building capacities to overthrow and break neoliberalism. But this is completely tied up in this period, given the power structures, with breaking with capitalism, in my view. The second thing about this is the rapidity with which the crisis has switched its forms. What began in 2007 as essentially a liquidity crisis in subprime credit markets mutated into a general insolvency crisis across a range of financial institutions, and very quickly into a whole range of countries. Brian was laying it out in terms of Ireland as one case where a liquidity crisis, a general insolvency crisis started involving, but also in Latvia, Iceland, and so on. So it completely and quickly moved centers. Now, the volume of the asset bubble and the financialization and the way it collapsed meant it soon morphed into a general economic crisis. That economic crisis unfolded through 2008-2009. It had led to a contraction in the world market. In the advanced capitalist country, the average rate of output fall was about 2.5 to 3%. For the first time since the Great Depression, there was a general decline in the world market and the world trade. So this was a crisis that encompassed the whole world market, and no zone was left untouched by that crisis. In response, there were a number of rescue strategies that the capitalist class and capitalist states deployed and had immediately deployed. And I think it's important to keep in mind this was in the context of generalized neoliberal forms of the state, and there was in mind not to repeat the problems that occurred in dealing with the great crisis of the 1930s. So immediately the state moved in a number of specific forms. One of the ways that the rescue took was, of course, immediately attempting to shore up and deal with the banks that were collapsing rather than allowing them continue the collapses continue to unfold. The second thing is the central banks and treasuries began intervening in a range of securities markets, commercial paper markets, in the general money markets as a whole, to attempt to make sure that the liquidity was maintained and those markets were functioning at some level. For quite a period, this depended upon the state doing so. For about a year and a half to 2 years, this, as we've seen from the WikiLeaks, this was in the data there, this was an intervention of the American state across the globe and sustaining it for about 2 years. Thirdly, is that there was so much fraud, deception, problems, and trying to understand what was on balance sheets. The regulatory institutions moved into the financial sector in major ways to try and start looking at what were the problems of each individual firms' balance sheets and their leverage position, and attempted to try and start sorting out the books and reestablishing each of those institutions. The central banks also then were involved in driving interest rates basically down to zero across the advanced capitalist world, which also drove interest rates down around the globe. And the final thing that moved was important in terms of the rescue strategies is there was a coordinated response with the first major meetings of the G20 in Washington, followed by London and Pittsburgh, to coordinate a fiscal rescue strategy, which were to move the G20 states into a fiscal position of about 2-5% deficits to try to make sure there was effective demand to stop the world market from collapsing. The other component of the G20 was an attempt to prevent a ratcheting up of tariffs and any kind of protectionist measures from spiraling to try to ensure that global free trade was maintained. So you can see that the forms of the rescue strategies were quite clearly set in opposition to what had occurred in the 1930s to prevent a breakout of the same kind of unfolding crisis over 10 years through the 1930s into the 1940s. But this just pushed, in many ways, the crisis into a different form. And this is the stage of the crisis that we're now in terms of it taking the form of a public sector crisis. The effect of these measures, both of the movement into deficits, the movement, the shock to revenues from the decline in output, and the bringing in of so much of the bad loans, et cetera, that were on banks and other financial institutions' balance sheets into the public sector has mutated into a crisis of the public sector as a whole. This is the case across the advanced capitalist country, but as Brian was mentioning, how we understand that depends a lot on the nature of the banking crisis that occurred in each case and the form it took, the way that the public sector crisis is unfolding. There is a number of important themes, what's happened in and around the exit strategies and some of the difficulties that are occurring that show that we're still in, I think, I would say a phase of the crisis, a different phase of the crisis, but I would also think and say that we're still in a phase of neoliberalism. Neoliberalism not in the sense of every practice reflecting less market and less state and more market, but in the general ideological way that the states are addressing the crisis, which was the key to neoliberalism as a whole, not that it was less state and more market, but also the way that they're attempting to reestablish many of the key distributional features of neoliberalism, many of the key financialization features of neoliberalism, and the way that they're attempting to restructure the state. One of the exits that has occurred occurred is around the question of additional financial regulation. And that was a theme of so much of the social democratic movement that the crisis demonstrated that you could not leave markets to themselves. You had to have extensive of state regulation of the financial sector. And the consequence of the crisis was to be a form of financial regulation that would rein financial capital back in. But when we look at the measures that have been taken, these are incredibly modest. There's the small German measures that have been taken on short selling. There's been some small European Union measures on controlling aspects of incentive structures and payments to the banking sector. There's been the modest measures of the Basel Accord, which are pushing banks to tighten up their balance sheets and their leverage ratios. And, of course, in the key case in the U.S., we had the Dodd-Frank Wall Street Reform Bill, which really demonstrated, the power of Wall Street in the reforms. There's very little that shakes up Wall Street. What's the quote that Doug uses in his essay? I was asked to write on Wall Street, what happened, nothing, end of essay. It was so little that the financial reforms have done in transforming the nature of financial power in the U.S., the widely discussed thing, the thing that was the main demand over the last 20 years, at least, or not 30 years, was the financial transaction tax, was the main social democratic demand, popularly known as the Tobin tax. And a few countries in Europe have adopted some small measure with respect to this, but it is so tiny and so small that it's even less ambition than the Tobin tax was initially. So it's left much of the nature of financialization in place, and most of the regulatory structures that have been attempted are attempts to reestablish the forms of financialization that have been characteristic of neoliberalism. The second exit strategy that has been pushed, particularly from the central banks, the IMF has particularly been pushing for this, with the Bank of International Settlements and a range of the financial institutions, has been a return to so-called normal monetary policy, to begin pushing back up interest rates, to lessen the role of the central banks in the money markets and completing some of the shortages in markets. This has been very problematic in moving away from the exceptional monetary policy measures. And you can see it especially in the U.S. with the Reserve moving in its quantitative easing measures of $600 billion that it's added, because of the general weakness of the economies and this fear that we're still in a phase where it could be a quick reversion back to a severe form of crisis. And the instability and problems that still remain with the banks' balance sheets. This exit has been hard to move away from. I think the third main exit that's been important has been the fiscal exit, which has centered around who will pay for the crisis, and has been the focus of what Brian and I were writing about, the form that this exit has taken. This has been the focal point of much of the political effort of the right over the last year and a half, and it's been led by the international agencies have been leading it, and followed by the G20 trying to ratify the particular norms inside states. The IMF initially began calling, in 2009, began calling for 10 years of austerity. And 6 months later, looking at the problems of states' balance sheets and the move to deficit, they began talking about 20 years of austerity. This is, of course, on top of the 30 years of austerity that we've known neoliberalism to be. So we're in this incredible long-term phase dealing with austerity, which the ruling classes expect to go on into the future. I think the call for that austerity is not only a reflection of how they want the crisis to be paid. They want the working classes, and particularly the working classes, the poor and the marginalized, to pay. They also expect that the problems of the crisis are, and the general issue of stagnation, is going to carry on for a long time. The movement into fiscal exit strategies raises a couple of important issues. One of this is the question that we've all been discussing and trying to figure out whether we're able to move into another phase of growth, is, of course, that it's reproducing the conditions that have been characteristic of neoliberalism, that is, the forms of weakness of effective demand, because neoliberalism has been characterized by forms of competitive austerity from the beginning. That is, a tax on working class wages as a whole, particularly in the private sector, to aid competitiveness, and then spreading into the public sector through various forms of social austerity, cuts on transfer payments, cuts on benefits for working class people, and generalized constraint over public sector wages. The impact of competitive austerity after the crisis, what it means for where new effective demand will come from, and how long we'll be facing problems of stagnation, is, I think, a very important calculation and assessment to the left of the conjuncture we're in. And I think, following what Brian was said, I think an important calculation for the political struggles and the forms of political organization we will be needing to build. This is not a short-term crisis that we're addressing, but a long-term phase of stagnation that is going to require new forms of working-class agency and resistance. I think a second aspect I think is important in thinking about the fiscal exits is the extent whether what's evolving in the response to the crisis is an exceptional form of the state. Whether the state is hardening to a degree that we'll begin seeing exceptional features. Whether you'll see in some places very sharp attacks on democracy coming from the political right, given that much of the political momentum at this moment in the advanced capitalist cores is coming from the political right. In my view, clearly we can see many features of exceptional state apparatuses being formed in this period. That is, specific aspects of the state are not exceptional in terms of normal liberal democratic states, but are becoming norm. That's one of the things I think we saw in the G20 in Toronto over this year, was, of course, is the growth and forms of the coercive apparatuses of the state. Those budgets, for the most part, are protected in the fiscal exits. There's some slowdown in the rate of growth, but for the most part, they're protected. And across the board, we're seeing increased money going into the domestic security apparatuses. This had always occurred from 9/11, but the effect of the crisis and the forms of resistance that are expected to continue to unfold have pretty much all the advanced capitalist core states putting more money into the coercive apparatuses of the state. We also see that the way that the cuts are being dealt with in most states, you can see it in Britain and in the U.S. in particular, but most states have a particular form of it. In Canada, we have it in a particular way that power has been concentrated in the Prime Minister's office and then particularized and personalized to some extent around Harper, is that we have special apparatuses being formed to deal with the nature of the cuts, to insulate it from political opposition of other elected members and to strengthen the capacity of the state to push through very severe cuts. In Britain, this has been the Office for Budget Responsibility, which has taken on this role in driving the cuts through. In the states, given in the U.S., in the case of how dealing with the political compromises that are necessary in the U.S., it's taken the place of the National Commission for Fiscal Responsibility, which is working out the political compromises, which will then try and drive it through. At the subnational level in the U.S., at the state level and the city level, you can see a lot of forms of exceptional state dealing with this and the way that the budget cuts are being driven through. I think this is a very important feature of this period of the state, which is different than other earlier phases of neoliberalism, which show some of the exceptional features that are occurring. I think a lot of the other ways that the exits are occurring are also characteristic of the worst features, many of the worst features of neoliberalism, and they are being intensified. Some of this is in terms of the expenditure cuts, and the layoffs, which are some of the biggest cuts in terms of percentages that have occurred over the entire phase of neoliberalism. The norm being argued for is 5 to 10%, although because of the general stagnation and the deepening of the deficits and the volume of debt in each state, this is expected to go on for a period. One of the other features is the way that tax loads are being continued. And tax cuts being continued. It's incredible that in this period of cuts to expenditures, particularly the most vivid cases have been in Greece and Britain, where the fiscal cuts have been matched by corporate tax cuts. In Greece, this was an exceptional, given the degree of the cuts that occurred. And in Britain, also. In fact, the cuts that occurred to the banks in terms of their tax load are better than they were pre-crisis. So there's a major shifting of the way taxes are occurring inside the advanced capitalist core and the way it's been shifted onto working class people. Another important characteristic is the layoffs that are occurring in the public sector are not only layoffs. The British case is very telling. But this has also been occurring across the advanced capitalist core, and especially actually in the Scandinavian countries have been particularly using this, and that's there's been an incredible amount of offshoring of public sector jobs. So many of the tasks remain, but you have a turn to a massive offshoring of the jobs as part of the layoff structure. There's been the attack on pensions and so on. When we look at the way that the cuts are occurring across the public sector, besides some of the characteristics I mentioned of the increased money going to the coercive apparatuses of the state, there are three areas that are critical. Some is the rollback in pensions, but there's a lot of variations the way the fights of pensions are going, given the differences in pension structures across the world. The key area where cuts are occurring is then on public sector wages and a systematic cut in those wages. And the other thing is, in fact, the cuts to welfare payments. It's the poor, when we look at alongside public sector workers, are paying for the crisis. It's incredible the amount of cuts that are occurring across the public sector as a whole on the cuts. Let me wrap up in dealing with the phases of resistance and some of the issues that Brian was touching upon that. When we look at the way that political resistance has occurred to the crisis, I think we're also seeing some different phases. In the first phase in 2007-2008, there were a lot of kind of spontaneous insurgencies around strikes, housing occupations, debtor strikes, and so on. There was difficulty in having these accumulate. And so much of those kind of stalled, particularly in the U.S., many of those stalled. The other phase then was some of the general strikes that occurred in Europe in, around 2008-2009. But those again stalled. And I think the question now is of whether we we'll be entering into another wave of responses to the public sector attacks as the austerity exits kick in. Everywhere you're seeing a new momentum among public sector unions and workers around strike activity. This is likely to sustain itself over the next year. You have a lot of coalitions forming at the base in various campaigns of resistance around students, obviously the most vivid example being Britain, but also what occurred in California a year ago. And you find everywhere new forms of coalitions appearing. And I think it's going to be important that those coalitions continue to develop and we find ways to deepen and broaden the struggles over each sector and in each sector and begin to unite them across these sectors. It's clear that you're going to have a lot of fightbacks, for example, in Ontario, in around the healthcare sector, in around housing, in around some of the other privatization fights, and it's clear that we need to build those and have public sector unions and community groups in them. But we're also going to have to develop capacities to begin to unite those struggles across these different sectors. And that, I think, turns to what Sam was speaking about in terms of building capacities so we can not juxtapose struggles and battles in the street against parliamentary struggles, but finding ways to unite those struggles. And I think the importance of Noam's essay is not only that, but his emphasis on the need for a radical imaginary that just does that. We're also sharing the podium today with David's book launch on the global slump, which also is in a new book series from the U.S. that Sam Liu and I have a book in as well from last year. And I think what's common in the themes from this year's Socialist Register, our book, and David's new book, is the thing that David puts forward in the final chapters. He poses the question of how are we going to build and move toward a great resistance. And I think that's the particular struggle that is on the agenda right now and that we face in developing our own political capacities in the City of Toronto. Thank you.